Accession number 6388, reel 4.
Colonel Dibbons, reel 4.
Okay. The engineers were getting well forward on this job, and it was taking, to me, good shape. As I was going down to talk to them, I was stopped by a major, a very irate major, who told me that I had to get together a shooting party, which, by the way, is 12 men, because they'd picked up a couple of spies or collaborators, and we thought they would have to die.
Were these French civilians?
They were civilians, yeah. I don't know, I didn't ask whether they were French or Belgian, you see. And this disturbed me no end, because I had no knowledge whatsoever about shooting spies or anyone else at that moment of time. So I got one of my corporals to go and find the assistant provost marshal, which he did, and he came back. And I told him my problem, and he said, well, you leave it to me, and I heard no more about it at all. So I don't know what happened to the so-called spies. No knowledge. I got on with the job I was doing, but I never at that moment of time got down to the jetty again, because I was doing something else. Whilst the jetty was in operation, we were also embarking troops from the beach in the small boats. We were doing a dual job. The jetty was being used for the same purpose, but we police... We had a couple of policemen on the sand where the pier started, to see that no more than 50 went aboard the gangway, the gangplank at any one time, or the jetty at any one time. And then, in addition, we were embarking fellows on the odd boat that came in, and there were plenty of odd boats that came in, straight into the boats from the shore. So we were doing a dual job.
Can you describe how the jetty was actually made?
Yes, again. It was built the jetty was built head to toe. The lorries were run out into the, whilst the tide was out, run out onto the soft sand. That's wrong. The dry sand, actually, where the tide had gone. They would take the sand, but not the soft sand as such. The lorry would, the sand would take the lorries, because it was hard sand. And then they were faced head to toe, and there were about 12 of them. They were then lashed together, the 12.
With a rope?
With rope. And then they were, the backs of them were loaded with sand.
To weigh them
anchor
down.
Them. The tyres were blown by rifle fire in the main, and so they were seated really on their wheels, on the hubs of their wheels, not the hubs of their wheels.
On the axles.
On the wheels proper, the metal sort of. They weren't resting on tyres. They weren't nothing pneumatic about them at this stage. Then the engineers got some planking from a nearby timber yard and put it over the roofs of these lorries, and between the two lorries, where the nose, the bonnet of the lorry is, you know, in the next stern of that particular vehicle. And so we had a gangway or a plankway running along from the beach, and when the tide was in, of course, they could still get to, touching it. Still get aboard this this jetty, because we'd extended it to some distance beyond where the tide was flowing at that time anyway. So we marched, the chaps were brought down, they weren't marched, they were brought down on the beach, and put on this gangplank. And from there they could drop either side of this row of vehicles. In other words, either side of the gangway, a gangplank. Because, of course, we, as opposed to having the lorries broadside, which they could only go then from one side, which was the tail of the line, whereas with this case they could go either side. This was the whole essence of this thing, and I think it made this jetty of ours much more effective.
Did the Germans try to attack the jetty?
Not at that stage. Now, I don't know whether you want this in here.
Yes.
I've read Operation Dynamo. I've read a copy of it. And in there it makes it clear to me that this jetty of ours was the first to be built. And then this was followed on by one at La Panne. I know nothing about La Panne, except that I know there was one there now. I know also that it was built in a different style to the one, or constructed in a different style to the manner in which ours was constructed. The Germans know that the first time they hit this thing was, I believe, on the Saturday morning, and then they hit the lorry which was farthest into the sea, the most distant lorry, with a shell. But they didn't wreck the pier. But at that time, I wasn't there. I'd left Bray Dunes and made our way into. I was making our way into Dunkirk at that time. Now, what else do you want?
So, which particular day was the jetty constructed?
Thursday, on the Thursday morning. And it came in, obviously, and it was working by midday, if not earlier. And so it went on all through the rest of that day and all through the night. I mean, this was continuous, this evacuation of troops was continuous. And it wasn't confined, the troops weren't confined to just British. I mean, they were French, and I take it Belgian, but anyway, they were Allied troops. They weren't all British by any manner of means.
What was discipline like as far as embarkation was concerned?
Once we got this thing organised, once we took over control, discipline was good. We had no serious problem. I had no serious problem at all with being mobbed to get into boats once we got this thing organised, 50 people at a time. I mean, I think our troops accepted that was the best thing that could happen. One couldn't enforce discipline anyway. We had no possibility, no power, no possibility of enforcing discipline, because there was nothing you could enforce discipline with, only a gun, and that was no damn good, because these folk, most of them had their rifles or whatever, and so it was basically enforced because we were able to enforce it. Because these soldiers were in fact disciplined as such. They knew fully well that we were doing the best to get them out, the best that possibly could be done to get them out. And on the Thursday, and I must mention this, on the Thursday, we weren't being machine gunned, we weren't being blasted from the air.
Why not?
On the day of this jetty. Well, what I've read is because the Germans themselves had no more planes they could use, and in fact we got... When Spencer Churchill got back to England, we were told that part of his job was to tell the Prime Minister that we need cover, aircraft cover. And in fact, we saw some British planes over that day. And if there were loose planes about, which there were, they were bombing the stuff out at sea, attacking the ships out at sea still. But we didn't see them on the beach.
How did the officers behave on the beaches?
I didn't see many officers. I didn't. I'm being perfectly frank here. I didn't see many officers. Where I did see them and where I had contact with them, they were in charge of their particular units or squads or whatever, and it seemed to be the right to officer men set up. My captain, the one I spoke to with the sappers, I never saw him again. But I was told that the officer who took over control of that jetty, building what I term our jetty, was carried out by a Lieutenant Bennett. And he was the fellow who stayed behind with this section of sappers to maintain it. When I got this thing started, or when I got this brainwave, I never thought for one moment of maintaining the jetty. That never crossed my mind. I thought you just built it and left it there. But of course, I saw and learned later that naturally the tides take their toll on jetties of this type, because they're not truly fixed.
Did you have any problems with, whilst you were organising the embarkations, with officers who outranked you refusing to take your orders?
No. I had one occasion, but that was in Dunkirk later, where I had a problem with a full colonel, but we sorted that out with a problem anyway.
Why did you move from Bray to Dunkirk?
Should I tell you a funny incident?
Yes.
Yeah. My major came, that's the assistant provost marshal, came down to the beach and got hold of me and said, we're leaving here. And at this time, evacuation was almost nil. We seem to have cleared the fellows from the dunes, but you must have in mind, or bear in mind, that they were coming in all the time. But at this particular time, which was roughly 7 o'clock on the Friday evening, so far as I knew, there were no soldiers left in the dunes to be embarked. There was nothing happening on the beach as such. And he told me that we were to pack up and walk along the, under the shelter of the dunes. We were being gunned by the Germans, by the German artillery. They were sending over shrapnel and heavy stuff onto the beach and where we were. And so therefore the major said that, well, we're you to march in single file and march, he said, but I mean you could walk under the shelter of the sand dunes, you see, keep close in, and so get the fellows together. And that was it, you see. But at that time, he was there, I saw a lone figure out on the beach where the tide ebbed, you know, out on the water line, is the word I want. And he had a gallon jar in his hand. I could see this. He was some, perhaps, 200 yards from me. And I thought, well, what's that fellow doing over there? And I walked over. And he was a sergeant in the RAMC. And he was pickled. He was tight. And the rum jar smelt strongly of rum. So I asked him what he was doing there, and sort of thing, you know. And he said, well, he told me it was a black card out of the hat. One in every 100 medicos had to stay behind to look after the chaps who were in hospital. And he'd drawn the black, I understood him to say, the black card. And so therefore he had to stay behind. And he gathered himself this what was left in this rum jar and was quite happy about it all.
So
I left him there.
He would have been captured.
Oh yes.
So, can you tell me why it was that you moved to Dunkirk now?
Because, from our point of view, Corps headquarters had finished. At this time, I've later learned, General Alexander took over control of the complete control of the evacuation. So, Lord Gort and the Corps commanders had gone back to England, and most of the divisional commanders. And all that was left behind now in the way of generals was General Alexander.
Can you tell me what happened to you at Dunkirk?
Yes. We walked along this beach for perhaps 3 miles, and we were being shelled all the time. I say we were being shelled, they were going over the sand dunes, but we were getting something of a backlash from shrapnel. And the major decided, and this would have been about 9 o'clock, that we should better lay up in the sand dunes until the darkness. And so he went off on his own and left me with these chaps. And by this time I was very tired of walking along the sand. This is purely personal. And I saw a lorry embedded into the sand up to its axles. And I got hold of the major's driver, as usual, a man named Smith, and I can't trace him to save my life, and said, "Go over there, Smith, I'll come over with you and see if we can, if this lorry will work, if the engine works." Which he did, and the engine turned over and it started, and that was it. So I got about a dozen of our chaps, and with bits of timber and tarpaulins and ground sheets and whatever, we got this lorry out of this deep sand onto the hard sand by where the sea had been, you know, where the tide had flowed in and out, And I told him to, we got it facing Dunkirk. It was facing the other way for a start, but we turned it towards Dunkirk. And I told him to take out the distributor, because we've been losing motorcycles with our allies, I take it. Just starting the motor up and running it away, you see. So we took out the plugs out of our motorcycles. We used to, so when we parked the motorcycles, the plugs were taken out. And so because of this, I got this driver to take out the distributor, which he did. We went back into the sand dunes then, and it was almost dark, and we were really being shelled too. Anyway, it was 2 o'clock in the morning, and we were still being shelled badly, and this damn lorry was out on the hard sand. And the APM said to me, "Get the men together. We'll march on into Dunkirk, you see, or at least the rear headquarters." And I got hold of Smith, and I said, "You stay with me, Smith." I said, "We're taking the lorry in, you know." And I let them go. I phoned up the men, let them go. And after they got away in the darkness, I got hold of Smith, and I remember running to this lorry and saying, "For God's sake, get the other side of this lorry. This bloody shrapnel'll have us before we finish." And he had to put the distributor head in, you see, cap in, which he did. And we got the lorry moving. We hadn't got 50 yards before we found some poor so-and-so on the sand there, was badly injured, his leg almost gone. And so we stopped and picked him up. We're still being shelled. I'm being frank here, this is perfectly true. So he was a good sort. I tried to trace Smith, I hadn't been able to. And he was an AA man. And we then caught up with the body of our troops, you see. And of course, I said to the major, "Well, we had this lorry, sir." And Smith and I thought Smith was his driver, you see. It'd be easier to travel in the lorry than it would be on foot. With which he agreed, and he turfed me out of the front of the cabin of the lorry, and I had to go in the back of the lorry then. So we went on a little way, and then we picked up two more wounded fellows, but they had a medical bloke with them, medical fellow, corporal or something. And so we picked them up and put them in the back of the van, in the back of the truck. And then we got to the promenade at Dunkirk, outskirts of Dunkirk. And we had to get through this soft sand again, which we dug this confounded lorry out of. So then we had to find bits of loose timber and tarpaulin sheet and that sort of thing, run up this slope with the beach. What do you call it? Lost it. Anyway, we got the lorry up, because these poor chaps in the back were screaming with pain. And having got onto the roadway, we then got this medical fellow to tell us where the hospital was. And we took them to the hospital, and that was roughly up past 4 in the morning. We then went on to rear headquarters, and we must arrive there at daybreak, where we broke up, rather. The most extraordinary thing happened to me there. I saw a brigadier cutting a grass, or part of a grass lawn, which had already been cut with a distinct arrow in it, pointing towards the last bridge over the canal. And this brigadier was running up and down with a hand mower, cutting out this arrow. Most extraordinary.
Did you see the arrow?
I did. It was probably, if you wanted the size, I would say it was probably 8 feet long and 4 feet with the two pieces coming out. Well, I saw him finish it off so that no one would recognise it. And the grass was about 4 inches deep, you see. And then I made my way, and my chaps made my way into a nearby field or paddock. And I saw a very courageous thing there. There was a sergeant major with a anti-aircraft gun firing at these German aircraft as they came over. They were blasting this place and shelling it also where we were. There was a chateau, and this was what I was told was rear headquarters, and the brigadier was in command. And it was at this stage where I was told there was some breakfast if I wanted some, and I went in with, I found two other officers in there. We were all wearing tin hats, you know, and we were in, for what it was worth, battle gear, of course we were. And we'd taken our hats off, and there was a hat stand there, and hung them up, and the fella came along, and the waiter chap came along, and I think I had coffee or tea and something, and bacon and eggs, and seen it for days. And we were in there, I was in the middle of this bacon and eggs, when Jerry Shaw started to get to, oh, much, much too close, the building started to shake. The three of us, from this very long table, got up, we weren't sitting together, went to the hat stand, got our metal hats, sat down and finished the breakfast. That is not a bad story, but it's a factual one. Sounds a bit, but having done that and got back again outside, and this was with my chaps. Now, by the way, that sergeant major, I later learned, was shot aboard a ship. He was killed. He was bombed, machine gunned aboard a ship that he was going home on. This is what I was told, and I believe it to be fact, that he was a terribly brave chap. He boosted morale on his own in the middle of this damn field. And were these so-and-so's, you know, amazing. Boosted me, anyway. But the major sent for me or found me or whatever, and he said, the brigadier has told me that providing we supply, that's the military police supply, one officer and 8 NCOs for duty at General Alexander's headquarters in Dunkirk, the rest can make their way to the docks and go home. And I was so full of war at that time, I volunteered for this job. And so that was that, with the proviso that I retained the lorry. I didn't want to walk into Dunkirk. I wasn't fond of walking. And very tired as well. But that was agreed, and so I sent a cop, one of my men, who drove the lorry down into Dunkirk, the docks, and unloaded the major and the rest of the chaps, and then brought the lorry back to me. And then the 8 of us made our way into Dunkirk, the headquarters. And there I got in touch with the General Alexander's G1, which is a lieutenant colonel, and asked him what he'd like me to do. And he said, well, you and the sergeant better stay here. And I had one motorcycle left. I had this lorry, which I'd parked over there somewhere, and one motorcycle left. And the motorcyclist, he said, and the rest better get down the town and do what they can to ease the movement of the troops forward, you see, and direct them, lead them, or whatever. So this is, in effect, what I did, complied with that instruction. And I and the sergeant and motorcyclist stayed around this headquarters. I didn't see General Alexander till later in the day, but in the meantime, in the yard of this building, I saw a load of timbered packages with the WD arrow on them, and I went over with the sergeant to see what they were, and I saw they were M&V, which was meat and vegetable ration, and biscuits. army biscuits, you know. And so I thought, well, and we were getting troops coming by this place, marching down to, no vehicles, we had no vehicles there. It was in Dunkirk, before I got here, that I had trouble with this colonel fellow, a full colonel. He was driving a vehicle, and in the attempt trying to give me orders, which I wouldn't accept, and I just told him to abandon his vehicle and walk. He didn't enjoy it, but that's what he did. But getting back to these cases, you know, so we got some sort of tool out of this lorry and started to break open these cases. And before I knew where I was, I found I had a captain, French, behind me with a sticking a pistol in the ribs. Revolver, whatever. And I'm not the easiest of people to handle and under circumstances like this, and I turned around and was a bit sharp with him. Between us, he couldn't speak English and I couldn't speak anything but pidgin French. But fortunately for me, at this particular moment, the colonel came out. What's the trouble? And he was a French linguist as far as I was concerned. And it seemed that a major had told the Frenchman he could have these rations. French officer. And of course he thought I was stealing them from him. Anyway, it was all settled. We divided the two. Divided, and there were quite a lot there. I mean, I take it, I would think, reflection. Probably 8 cases of each. 8 boxes of each. And they'd have 6 small boxes inside because they were as large as his table. That sort of size. And as the troops came through, and a lot of guardsmen came through during the rest of that day, I got hold of their officer, and whilst they were marching, I said to him, can I give your chaps rations? And they were all hungry. We'd had no food. We'd had no proper food. We'd had very little water on the beach. We got what we got from the naval ships or the ships out at sea. And that's how I came to make tea and with these chaps who were badly injured and wounded. And of course, we had a lot of shell-shocked people. Got away from this on the beach, you see. These chaps had been blown up not once, but twice out of ships. And they brought them ashore, and I mean, they were obviously complete nervous exhaustion and what else, whatever goes with it. Well, the ones that were fit enough to go back, I saw to those chaps first, and they got them some tea laced with brandy, which was very useful. The brandy, I mean. And so that's how we dealt with those fellows. The ones that were very injured, we could do nothing else but to get them to the local casualty clearing station or hospital, whatever was the nearest, whichever was the nearest. Going back to my biscuits, that was an adventure. The French officer and I shook hands, and as I say, I said, well, that's yours and this is ours. And I issued these things out to... We had a lot of guardsmen come through that afternoon, in units, marching properly, regular, properly drilled, instructed, and marching in platoons, you know. And then they were all truly disciplined, these fellows, and they must have come from the front line itself. And anyway, we disposed of these rations. And then, roughly at about 5 or 6 o'clock, the general came by, General Alexander, and I had then, by this time, about 50 or 60 soldiers there, stragglers. None of them had any rifles. I just didn't know any about rifles. It didn't worry me. I mean, the question is, what are we going to do with these fellows? I've got to get them, try and get them back to England. And he came over to me and he said, where are these men's rifles? I said, well, no, it is, sir. He said, well, who are they? What are they? Where do they come from? I said, well, the stragglers. So he said, well, you better see that they get rifles before they go back to England because we should need them. And so I chased around then, and of course there were rifles lying about all over the darn place. I mean, I can't tell you whether I was able to arm a lot of them or not, but I got a lot of them rifles because in case the general came out again. But I never saw him after that. We, at around 9 o'clock or half past nine, the colonel, the G1, came out to me and said, well, the headquarters is closed, it's finished, and you can move your fellows now down to the docks. You and your chaps can go down to the docks. And I said, thank you, sir, sort of business, you know. And which, by the way, at that time we hadn't been bombed or machine gunned where we were. They were still going out in the port. They were still machine gunning and bombing the ships out at sea. But we hadn't.